Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, July 7th, 2018. It's just after 3:30 UTC as we're starting to record. I've been forgetting to say the time in recent episodes, and I guess no one cares but me, but you know, whatever. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Bo is not with us today. He's feeling a little under the weather. He only told me about that like a couple hours before the show. He's like, you know, I'm not feeling good. I can't do the show. And so I sent out a note to all the usual suspects who've expressed interest in sometimes doing the show. And good old reliable Ed said, I can do it, even though it's less than 2 hours notice. So hello, Ed. Welcome to the show yet again.
Hello. My life at my age is wide open for the most part.
So we have four main segments this time around, and these are Ed's picks. As usual, when I have a guest host on that's not myself or Yvonne, I let them pick most of the agenda. So what do we have? We have North Korea. We haven't talked about North Korea in a while. There have been a few developments, and Ed also wanted to compare it a little bit to what's been going on with Iran. Topic two, the Supreme Court again. We did talk about the Supreme Court last week some. Talked about a few different cases, and Judge Kennedy was resigning. And of course, soon after the show is released, on Monday, President Trump is supposed to announce his choice to replace Justice Kennedy. But we want to concentrate here specifically on what really is the risk for old cases and precedent and how much the court will reverse. You know, everybody's worried about Roe versus Wade, or excited about Roe versus Wade, depending on their point of view. But what's really the level of risk? And then topic number three, the military and immigrants. There was a story that came out in the last 24 hours before we're recording about the military perhaps kicking some folks out who are on track to become citizens through their participation in the military, and we'll talk about that story, what's behind it, and also I've heard a few caveats of people saying, well, don't get ahead of yourself here. This may not be all that it seems. And then other people saying, well, yeah, it is. And then finally, point four, we're going to talk about the ongoing trade war. So that is the agenda for the show. I had a couple things I wanted to mention in this first segment before we jump into all of those. First, last week, we called my wife, my daughter, my son in the car as they were on their massive road trip from the West Coast to the East Coast. And at the time that we talked to them, they had about 8 hours of driving left. So I did just want to give everybody an update. They made it. We recorded that interview with them close to midnight their time, as they were going on that trip. And they just continued straight through the night. They stopped a couple of times at rest stops to rest. But they didn't stop at a hotel that night. They just kept on going straight through the night. They arrived at their destination around 10 or 11 in the morning. And the wedding that they were trying to get to in time was at like 6 or 7 p.m. So they made it barely, but they did make it. Since then, they've been at my mother-in-law's house, and they've been doing whatever they're doing there. And Alex is doing okay being away from home. He still wants to come home, but he's not constantly mentioning it and complaining about it 24 hours a day like he was while they were cooped up in the car for a week while they were driving. So almost a week. So that's my update for that. The other thing I just wanted to touch on, even though we're not doing a major segment on it, I just want to call out the whole issue with the kids separated from their parents, with people seeking asylum and stuff like that, has not gone away. Yes, Donald Trump issued a policy change that said that they're not going to separate anymore, at least until they can figure something out. But the estimate of the number of kids separating from their parents has actually gone up to something like 3,000. And despite a judge issuing a court order that said, I got to put these people back together again right now, and with a very aggressive deadline, the administration told the court they were not going to make that deadline. They want an extension because they're having so much trouble getting people together. Because apparently, either the proper records weren't kept or they were destroyed. about, you know, who's attached to who. And, you know, so because they basically, once they were separated, they separated them out into two separate cases, one for the kid, one for the adult, and they didn't keep a proper paper trail to connect them to each other. And in some cases, they've already deported the adult while the kid is still in someplace in the system here. There's a huge mess. Apparently, only a very small number of these people have actually been reunited. Even if you're reuniting them, that you may be reuniting them in custody or deporting them together, whatever, you're not really solving any underlying problems here. But it's a huge mess. And yeah, I said on Twitter the other time, you know, given what you have put these families through, we not only owe them being put back together, they should probably get automatic citizenship at this point, plus a truckload of money, you know, because of this complete mishandling of everything and such a mess and such trauma that we've created specifically for the young children and even, you know, medium aged children. It's ridiculous. And they didn't necessarily have a choice in what was happening, and yet we are putting them through really unacceptable conditions. So anyway, I just wanted to mention it as an ongoing thing, because I think it's important that we don't forget that's going on.
Yeah, I really can't add much to it. It's a disgraceful episode in our nation's history, I'm afraid.
And continuing, you know, it's not over. So yeah,
it's kind of one of those things is just say, how did we get here? How can they keep those terrible records? And then the other thing is, I think it was you posted something today about that apparently they're not going to do anything on this weekend because one of the guys in charge is dog sitting.
Yep.
How is it that that becomes even an issue? But I don't know. It's just mind boggling. It really is.
Yes, unfortunately. Okay, we'll take a break and we will come back and we will talk about North Korea. Back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Okay, we are back. So, North Korea, Ed, you wanted to bring this up, and it is something that, you know, we haven't talked about it since before the Donald Trump summit, really. I mean, we've mentioned it in passing a couple times, but we never even really got into what happened at the summit or anything else like that, let alone developments since then. What are your thoughts? What prompted you to bring this up this week as something to talk about?
Well, a couple of things is one of which is apparently Pompeo is going to Korea again to meet with.
He's there right now as we're recording.
There must be some question because in one of the talk shows I heard today, I heard him saying that if Kim Jong-un refuses to meet with him, that would be a catastrophe. So there must be some question whether he'll even be greeted, which, you know, is kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, he's there as of now. He's certainly I don't know if he's met with Kim Jong-un yet, but he's met with a number of other high administration officials there. And I think what they've said is that the intention here is now he's here to hammer out all those details they didn't hammer out at the summit. I also saw a note that he will be passing on a CD of Elton John's Rocket Man signed by Donald Trump.
Good. Oh, that's important.
Do. Sam from the future here. The administration has since disputed that story and says that there was no CD of Elton John delivered. Do.
And then, well, the other thing that's been in the news sort of in passing is that there's some evidence that apparently the nuclear refinement facility is in full operation still. It has not slowed down its operations, which means they're still producing weapons-grade uranium and plutonium.
And they've apparently added some stuff in some other locations as well. Yeah. So this sort of ties to, you know, everything that people were saying about that summit and what came out of it, which was basically they signed a statement that said almost nothing at all. It reiterated things from previous documents that had been signed with the North Koreans. It said that they committed to talk some more and that they, you know, wanted to work towards whatever. But it was full of caveats and it was full of things that had already been agreed to and no change. So, like, you know, basically the bottom line was kind of what Yvonne and I had said before the summit even happened, that look, it really was just a photo op. It was just, you know, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un get to shake each other's hands and say hello and, agree to talk more. There wasn't anything that actually came out of that. However, you know, I've always been like a little bit surprised to find myself to some degree, defending Donald Trump on these kinds of things, because sometimes it actually is important to just start the conversation and to start having some sort of personal relationship there that lets you set up for other things. Having said that, so I don't completely say that, oh, it's just a photo op, therefore it means nothing. The fact that you came together and had a photo op in and of itself does mean something. However, in the process, you sort of, the North Koreans got a lot of things they wanted. They got to sort of look important and be recognized by the President of the United States and all of this. Donald Trump agreed to stop some military exercises and some other things. So it looks like he gave up some stuff for very little. The commitments that were made by the North were basically nothing because there was no definitions around anything, no mechanisms to check anything, no mechanisms for enforcement. It was just sort of, yeah, we like the idea of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. But in a very abstract way, in a way which, by the way, includes South Korea too. But what's the most, I don't know, disturbing out of this is that Donald Trump, in a number of situations now since the summit, has basically said, North Korea is taken care of now. We've solved that one. We're done. Yep. We're good. We have a deal. Whereas, in fact, as you said, the North Koreans appear to be continuing on with stuff. They didn't make any real commitments to anything. There were no details agreed to. But in Donald Trump's head, or at least maybe if not, who knows what's actually in his head, at least in the image he is trying to project, it's a win. He took care of that. We no longer have to think about North Koreans taken care of. And
well, he gets in his mind, he gets to define what is a win.
Right.
And therefore, his going there and shaking hands with Kim. I got to keep track of which is the last name. But anyway, shaking hands was a win. And they said nice things about each other. And, you know, that means that it was successful in the, you know, and he also, I mean, he touts the fact that, gee, they haven't blasted any missiles off and they haven't done any more tests.
And well, they haven't.
They probably don't need to at this point.
Right. They got what they needed out of that.
Yeah. They've done the testing they want. They are either building or have built the missiles that they want. They don't need to test them anymore. They now know how to steer them.
Yes. Having said all of that, I prefer where we are now to where we were when Donald Trump and Kim were trading insults every other day and threatening each other every other day. You know, as sort of like, okay, we haven't made any actual progress in eliminating North Korea's nuclear capabilities, et cetera, et cetera. You're true, but we have, you know, backed down. Well, I don't know if that's the right word, but we've de-escalated from where we were. And that's a net plus, I think. Now, of course, it's a de-escalation from an escalation that was unnecessary and in part driven by Donald Trump himself. You know, he made the situation worse so we could back off from it. And frankly, we're pretty much right back to where we were, except North Korea's capabilities are greater than they were. And it's one of those situations where, you know, frankly, as much as I like the idea of fewer countries having nuclear weapons, the bottom line is once they have it, it's really hard to back off from that. It's happened very rarely. I believe South Africa had nuclear weapons and after the end of the apartheid regime, actually got rid of them. But that's very rare.
That was a whole new government.
It was. But this is the kind of thing where, you know, I expect the reality is we now have to realize North Korea is a nuclear power and plan accordingly.
Yeah.
And frankly, as much as people are scared of that option, and I understand why they're scared, I also look at situations like India-Pakistan, where at least superficially, it looks like those two countries have been more reluctant to get into wars with each other since they both had nuclear weapons. You know? So
yeah.
It does have a deterrent effect as well, because people realize how serious it is. But I'm not giving Donald Trump a lot of credit for this. I think, you know, my three rules of Donald Trump that I stated a while back, and, you know, rule number one was perception matters more than reality. And I think that, you know, that is still very true here. And he creates his own perception because, you know, all he has to do is keep repeating, we took care of North Korea, we took care of North Korea, we took care of North Korea. And there's a certain portion of the population that'll just be like, oh, he took care of North Korea.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about, well, what does it really, what's really going on? What are the details here? It doesn't matter. As long as Kim doesn't actually nuke anybody, who cares? You know, we got the deal. We all looked good. Next.
Yeah.
Oh, I shouldn't mention. I said my three rules for understanding Donald Trump. I shouldn't do that. Just say one of them. The three rules are perception matters more than reality. Everything is a zero sum game. Rules are for suckers. And then I always add a bonus rule. He isn't that bright.
Did you see the cartoon today?
Which one?
It showed him in a debate with Elizabeth Warren. And he was saying, we're going to have you do a genetic test, Pocahontas. And she was holding up an IQ and says, and we're going to have an IQ test on you, idiot. Oh dear. Anyway, so yeah, no, he's. I don't know how bright he is. I'm scared that he may be brighter than we give him credit for.
Maybe, but I just looking at the evidence, I think I have said this before on the show. I think he has an instinct for certain things in terms of reading a room, reading a crowd, knowing what to say to manipulate people in a way that he wants them manipulated. I think he's got a skill for that. He's a good con man. But in terms of actual sort of intelligence and ability to comprehend, you know, complex systems and what's going on there, I just don't see it. And those two things are different things. One is an innate ability that just sort of comes naturally to him and is an important skill. It got him to the presidency. Let's be honest. But then it's a whole other thing to look at complex situations and try to figure out how different bits affect the other bits. And if you pull on this, what happens when it's not just, you know, how do I get under that guy's skin who's in front of me, you know? So
yeah.
Anyway, so you wanted to compare North Korea to Iran. So what's the comparison that you wanted to bring up?
Well, you know, both basically there were nuclear arrangements made in which a country would theoretically, in Iran's case, would stop its move to produce nuclear weapons, assuming that they don't have any yet. in North Korea's case, it was we will get rid of our nukes and not have them anymore. The thing is, when you compare the two, the one in Iran appears to actually have worked up to this point, in that they stopped producing weapons grade fission materials, and they shut down the plants that do that, and they're being inspected, and they've allowed the inspectors to come in, and it's doing what it was supposed to do. Now, there were a whole lot of other things it didn't do. Iran is still a bad actor. You know, they continue sponsoring terrorism and all sorts of stuff. But they honored their nuclear thing. And then our boy Trump says, well, they're just terrible people, and we're withdrawing from that. And if other nations continue supporting them, then we're going to have a trade war with them, too. And so Europe is, you know, needs Iranian oil. And they're really in a hard place because they want that oil. They want to trade with it. They say, look, Iran's honoring their deal. They've done what they said they would. North Korea hasn't really said they'll do anything yet. But the two deals in some ways are parallel, but the outcomes, well, at least at this point, appear different.
The thing is, the deals would be parallel. Like, if you really tried to do something meaningful in North Korea about North Korea's nuclear program, you'd have to set up the kinds of things that were in the Iran deal in terms of how inspections work and what you get to do and what you can do, what you can't do, how to inspect, how to verify, how to do all this kind of stuff. You know, a wildly successful negotiation with North Korea would end up with something that looked like the Iran deal that Donald Trump trashed.
Yeah.
You know, but yet the one in Iran was no good because of whatever, you know, because it didn't include the other things you mentioned, but mainly probably because it was Obama's.
I think that's the answer. Yeah.
Because North Korea, frankly, if let's assume that Pompeo goes in there and actually does start working through all these details and they actually get North Korea to agree to something and blah, 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 blah. You know, in their best case scenario, they're going to leave stuff on the table too. They're not going to, you know, insist that North Korea not do all kinds of other things outside of the nuclear program or change their behavior in this way or that way. It's going to be confined to the one area most likely, you know, so it will be very similar, you know, honestly, from all I've seen so far, I don't feel like anybody has any level of confidence that they'll actually be able to get to a meaningful deal in North Korea. Because at some point, I saw one person mention it, and I apologize for not knowing who, that basically there's a fundamental disconnect, right? Between the interpretations that the Americans and North Koreans are putting on that one statement. If you pay any attention whatsoever, you realize that they're very carefully interpreting certain phrases entirely different ways, you know? And either they're going to realize that they're actually in different places and come to blows over it at some point where, you know, you could just see Donald Trump starting to rant on the North Koreans have reneged on their deal because they're not doing XYZ, where the North Koreans never really felt they agreed to that in the first place. And you could see that putting us right back on the path of confrontation again, if that happened. Or everybody can sort of just pretend that they don't know that there's a disagreement there and just do what we've done so far, which is basically like, okay, well, we'll just keep saying we're agreeing, you know, even though it's obvious we disagree on the details. Oh, and it's obvious that you're sort of still doing some nuke stuff over there, but we'll just look the other way and ignore that.
Yeah. Well, you know, traditionally these sorts of pacts have had intensive negotiations for months ahead of time, answering all those questions. What's covered, what's not covered, how's it going to occur, how the inspections are again, all that's done. And then when the two leaders meet, that's at the end to sign the deal. This time, what we've done is the two leaders came together and signed it. And now they're going to start doing the negotiations. you know, who knows what's going to come out of it all.
Right.
And I think you're right. I think the biggest thing that Kim wanted was to be recognized as a major power, and with the president traveling all the way to Asia to meet with him, that says, hey, I'm an important guy. And other nations are now starting to pay attention to him. He got the most important thing he wanted, which is that he's on the national stage now.
Right. On the international stage. And he's had more meetings with China than he had before, because he'd been sort of on the outs with them for a little while. And he's got a summit coming up with Putin, I believe, too. And he's making lots of progress. He's sort of shifted. Like a year ago, he was the international pariah that nobody was going to deal with. And now he's, you know, talking to the South Koreans. He's talking to the Russians. He's talking to the Chinese. He's getting this. He's getting that. He's, the sanctions regime that was put on, as long as, even though Donald Trump still says we're still engaging in maximum pressure or whatever, through this whole engagement, it's gotten a lot looser. So big win for Kim all the way around, as far as I can tell. And the question is, you know, whether Donald Trump can succeed in making it seem like it's a win for him too, you know, because, okay, if it's a win-win, that's great, right? But, and so far, his strategy is basically, on all things, just keep saying it over and over and over again, and eventually people will start to believe you.
Well, remember, he doesn't believe in win-win either.
Yeah.
There's a winner and a loser in every deal. And he always wins, he thinks.
Very true. Okay. Let's take a break. I think we've exhausted North Korea for now, and we will be back with the Supreme Court. See you in a minute.
AlexandTheWeb.com. Bang Alex and Dad. Gaming videos and more from Alex. Elementary school by day. YouTube by night. AlexMZilla.com. AlexMZilla is AlexMXELA. And .com is period and then COM.
Okay, we are back. So the Supreme Court. We talked about a whole bunch of Supreme Court cases last week. We talked about Justice Kennedy retiring. But you wanted to talk about precedent and sort of, no matter who Donald Trump nominates, are we really in danger of a lot of things being overturned right away? So what are your thoughts, Ed?
Well, the Democrats obviously have been raising hell, but whoever he nominates, it'll very clearly mean that Roe v. Wade is in great danger. And the LGBT gains that have been made will be in real danger. And indeed, and if you listen to the talk shows, the Republican folks who go on those shows are also saying, gee, it's we'll be able to throw these things back to the state. It's right. Not that abortion's illegal. It's that it ought to be a state decision, not a federal decision. Same thing on the LGBTQ. But the problem that I see for both of these sides is they're assuming that these justices will change the pattern that has been in place for most of the history of our nation, which is that once there's a precedent established, it's a firm precedent, such as Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court has been very hesitant to overturn it, even in such really bad cases as I forget the name, the Kennebunk or whatever it is, the precedent that allowed us to inter the Japanese in 1942. I mean, that precedent was not overturned, although in last week, the ruling that came out found it to be a terrible ruling and said that it was basically overturned, you know, without it being appealed. They overturned it without anyone actually appealing it to them.
Yeah, well, the thing is, though, and you're right, there is the general principle of upholding precedent most of the time. I believe it's stare decisis. And I'm sure our lawyer friends will correct me if I got that wrong. But but most of the time isn't all of the time. And every single term, the Supreme Court overturns a variety of things. or clarifies things or makes adjustments. I mean, that's kind of what they do. And so, you know, you're talking about in this last week, they said this about the Japanese internment case, but they also, reversed precedent on the public unions that had held for 20, 25 years, in the same week. And so I think they're on both sides, and this applies to both liberal and conservative judges. The bottom line is while they give deference in cases where they believe it's, a close call or fairly stable, like they don't want to just be overturning things willy nilly because that would, make things very unstable in terms of how to interpret things. But I think there's not an unwillingness to overturn things when they actually think that they were decided incorrectly. Now there is some, deference, I think, for, looking at the effects it would take. And this is different justice by justice, but like, Justice Roberts famously, was, the deciding vote on letting Obamacare stand. Yep. And he found a reason to do that. And it may well be, we don't have a lot of inside the court stuff coming out and leaking out, these days, but there's certainly an argument to be made that it wasn't from a sort of completely principled legal stand. I mean, he found this thing about like, let's call it a tax or whatever, but more just also understanding, well, what would the practical ramifications be if we undid this right now? And, there's the thing, the Supreme Court does read the papers. The book I'm reading right now is about, the Burger Court during the Nixon administration. So I'm actually reading a book about the Supreme Court right now. And as I'm going through this, the degree to which they are very, very much aware of the political context in which their cases occur is dramatic, because you have this sort of ideal notion that the court should be isolated from all that. They should be making these pure decisions based on the law and constitution alone. Okay, that's the ideal, but it's bullshit. It doesn't happen in real life. Now, to some degree, it does. We certainly get these rulings periodically where it's like the politicians on both sides of the fence are upset because the Supreme Court ruled on something on fairly narrow legal grounds or said, I disagree with this policy, but it's going to be here anyway because it was decided the right way, whatever. So you do get those. But for the most part, yeah, the court is aware of the situation around them. And that's the thing with choosing judges like this. Like, Donald Trump has basically promised to pick from a list that was pre-vetted in a way that tips towards people who would want to do something like reverse Roe versus Wade, even though you don't explicitly ask them that because that's taboo. There is a thing there where you're right. There might be some hesitancy to overturn major things. If the court wants to move in a direction, they find a way. I mean, sometimes it is a wholesale overturning, but more often things get nibbled away at, through a series of cases.
I guess my point is not so much, I wouldn't be surprised either way, but I'm less convinced that they will definitely overturn the precedents than I was a couple of weeks ago, as I hear some of the commentators who seem like pretty bright guys talk about it.
Yeah, one just as a basic, it takes a while for these cases to get up to the court anyway. There's a time factor at play, and there's how dramatic will they want to take an action? And it may well be that Roe or the marriage decisions are such that even a more conservative court would think a little bit before they did a complete overturning. But it is certainly within the realm of possibility. I would not be shocked at all. Now, the other part of it is, like you said, well, what is the result of, like, overturning Roe versus Wade? It would be putting it back to the states. People anticipate that given the current orientations of the state legislatures and everything else like that, it would probably result in abortion being illegal in some 33 states out of 50, somewhere between 25 and 33. But the federal government could legislate on that. You could imagine a world that if you had a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president, they could put a federal law in place overruling those state laws. And then that would go to court as well, of course, and you could see how that goes. But this is an area where, frankly, this is one of those areas where the court acted on what many people do think is fundamentally a political decision, and the gay marriage as well. Like, this ended up being decided in the courts. It could have been decided by legislators in the Congress. It's just that there wasn't quite yet, you know, the public support wasn't there to do it legislatively. But the court.
Well, I think the thing you run into there is, we weren't going to talk too much about gerrymandering tonight, but the legislatures are really handicapped on occasion and taking on some of these things, because even though something like 70% of Pennsylvanians want the gerrymandering ended, want reasonable districting to come up, it was defeated in our legislature this year, and it was defeated by a move of, when it got to the floor, over 400, I think it was 400 and some amendments were put into the bill, and they nibbled it to death. And it finally just died on the floor, never got voted on, and will not take effect. And I could see the same exact thing happening in a state where 60, 70% of the people believe that that abortion should be legal. And it comes to the floor of the legislature and just simply gets nibbled to death. And I think the gay community particularly said, we're not going to have that. If 70%, 60% of the United States believe we should have full citizenship rights, then by God, we're going to get it however we get it. And if we have to go to courts, we'll do it that way. If we can get legislatures to do it, that would be nice. But, I'm not sure that they're going to be that patient any more than I think Martin Luther King was going to be, Jr. was going to be patient in the 60s. He and James Farmer and all the others, they said, we've been patient too freaking long.
Right. I mean, and what, in terms of the court, though, I could see two options on the table, assuming we get Donald Trump's nominee gets confirmed, which I think is almost certainly going to happen. And so we have a conservative leaning court. Let's put it this way. I think there's a good chance that some of these precedents will be overturned completely. But in cases where they're not, I think you'll definitely see sort of the nibbling around the edges of them. But here's the other part of this. Again, like, it takes a while for these things to happen. And our attention spans are now like hours, whereas some of these things take years to happen. So, I could see a lot of talk of like, the new Supreme Court justice like gets nominated and like 2 months later, well, nothing big is blown up yet. So, what were all those people like hyperventilating about? Nothing big's happened yet. Well, it takes a while. They have to have the right cases in front of them. And sure, is it possible that some of them will happen right away? Maybe. There's things that are already in the pipeline. But even then, even if they have the hearings, late this year, it's months before.
It still takes a year.
Yeah. Well, not quite a year, but it takes them a while to do stuff. It's slow. And by the time you start seeing the results of it, you were long past the event that caused it. And the general population is really bad at connecting the dots for cause and effect that are separated by years.
Yeah.
Or even months, frankly. But I think we will see that. I mean, the bottom line, I think, is a conservative court will come up with conservative decisions and move things in a conservative direction and give the right a lot of the things they want. Will it give them everything they want? Probably not everything, but it will give them a lot. And especially when you put into play also the fact that this majority that's been putting in place now, Donald Trump is not a dummy. He's nominating young people. The top three are all fairly young folks. They're going to be in place for decades.
Yep.
And it's very likely, given the ages of some of the liberals on the court, that before Donald Trump is done, he'll get to nominate at least one more, maybe two. So we will have.
And at that point, we could have a real problem, because the other thing that's happened back when we could, when they could filibuster appointments to the Supreme Court, in order to get a judge through, they really had to not be a far right or a far left, either one,
right,
because you had to appeal to basically 2/3 of the senators would say, yeah, this is a good guy. And I'm pulling a blank on his name, the one that Reagan nominated that got turned down.
Judge Bork.
Bork. Bork was certainly qualified, but he was also a radical right. When they finally withdrew his nomination, the next guy was cleared in a matter of a couple of weeks. And I'm trying to remember who it was. That wasn't,
it was Kennedy. Kennedy was the third one. Douglas Ginsburg was between Robert Bork and Anthony Kennedy. So Robert Bork went down after a very contentious hearing and all kinds of things. And he was too right wing and blah, 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 whatever. The Senate ended up rejecting his confirmation. So it actually went to a vote. And they rejected him. The next one was Douglas Ginsburg, who had to withdraw his nomination because it had come out that he'd used marijuana once when he was a student.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, I'd completely forgotten about him. Yeah.
And then Anthony Kennedy, who's the one who just withdrew this a couple weeks ago.
So, but my point is that when you have to appeal to 2/3, it is much harder to get these guys
or 60
that are
votes, but it's not
way
two-thirds.
Right, way left, either one. You've got to come up. And Kennedy, no one is going to agree with everything he did, but he's been an incredibly good justice. I don't think we'll get that kind of quality anymore. What we're going to get are people who are basically much like the Congress. They're either a Tea Party or they're Antifa. Maybe not quite that radical.
And look, in terms of qualifications, everybody on that list that Donald Trump is working from has the basic qualifications to be a Supreme Court judge.
Robert Bork was highly qualified.
Yeah.
And he was also brave. I mean, he was the guy that Nixon finally got to fire his investigator.
Right.
He had to go through 3 or 4 people, but that was Bork's entry onto the main stage, was by saying, okay, I'll fire him for it.
Yeah, fundamentally, though, I think you're right. The fact that we've got rid of the judicial filibuster does mean you can get through more radical people. But I think that's frankly the reality. And like I've said numerous times on this show, I think the legislative filibuster is on its last legs, too. And at the next opportunity that makes sense, it'll disappear as well. Yep. And we're going to be in a world where, yeah, the majority gets to pick. Period. Like these various things where the minority had ability to force compromise or force more moderate options, those days are gone. Whoever's got, the 51 votes in the Senate, if they've got the House and the presidency as well, is going to be able to push through their agenda. Now, obviously, there are limits to that, even with, with the parties like this, as Donald Trump found out in terms of trying to repeal healthcare, because he had 3 Republicans defect. So if you've got this, 51-49 kind of balance, there's still room around the edges for occasionally somebody to defect and cause something to go the other way. But for the most part, we're going to be in a world where if you control the presidency, the House, and the Senate, you get to get what you want. And, I honestly don't know that that's that bad. On the one hand, when the people I don't like are in charge, obviously things that I don't like are going to happen. But it gives a lot more clarity when you come to elections, because you've basically, you know what you're getting. You know that these guys achieved this. They made these things happen. And I either like those things or I don't. Whereas in the sort of world of, you know, the filibuster and even when you have the House and Senate in opposite parties, or the Congress and the presidency in other parties, et cetera, you know, there's this blame game that goes on where, you know, the one side can just stop the other side for doing what they want and then blame them on not getting anything done, you know, so that the Republicans can go and say that Obama didn't do anything. He didn't get anything done. Well, why did he not get anything done? It's because the Republicans stopped it for the most part. It's not a matter of the party in charge did these five things that they ran on, and how do you like those things? Because the actual reality of what gets enacted is a big muddle. And if you do have sort of a straight up majority rules, then at the very least, you get to judge people by what did they actually do? Because they actually got a chance to do what they wanted to do without the other side stopping them. So I don't know. But yeah, we have drifted away from the Supreme Court itself, but back to the Preston idea. I think that a conservative court most definitely will reverse a lot of the precedents that liberals hold dear. Maybe not all of them, but there definitely will be reversals that come from that. And if we have a court with 5, 6, 7 conservative justices, by the time Donald Trump gets done nominating folks, then that's going to last a very, very long time. Absent radical proposals, which I now see liberals start talking about packing the court by adding more justices to the Supreme Court and stuff like that, which while I understand some of the thought process behind it, because A, the Constitution does not define how many judges there are in the court, that can be changed easily enough. You can add more. But if we get to a situation where we have a Democratic House, Senate, and presidency at some point in the future, but we have a Supreme Court, you know, that's 7-2 conservatives, I definitely understand where the temptation is to, well, let's just add justices until we have a majority again. But if you do that, you know, the next time the Republicans are in charge, they'll add some justices. And then the Democrats will add more the next time they're in charge. And we'll end up with 100 judges on the Supreme Court after a few cycles. You know,
how many is it? Poland? Is it 70 some?
I don't know. But
they're showing the advantage of having the justice be a lifetime appointment, because they just legislated something like about 50% of their justices out of work because they said you have to retire at 65.
Right.
Made it mandatory.
Yeah, I don't know the details of that, although I know it's been a big controversy over there.
Yeah.
But bottom line, I think that sort of court packing thing is just a recipe towards increasing chaos as things progress. Well, we'll see. We're talking years down the line before anything like that comes up, if ever. But for the moment, we're going to find out, I think, because I don't think the Democrats are going to stop this nomination. I think we're going to get a 5-4 conservative court, with the fifth vote being a solid conservative rather than a wishy-washy conservative. There's a question of whether Roberts or somebody moves left, I think, to compensate a little bit. We'll see. But I think we will get... I do not think that... I think it'll be quite a long time before liberals are happy with the Supreme Court again, because what the results of this nomination and potentially more nominations before Donald Trump is done are going to last a very, very long time.
Well, yep.
Okay. Enough
on the question. Yeah.
Enough on the court. Let's take a break. We will be back. What was next? Oh, yes. The military and immigrants and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Back after this.
Ready for the test, Dracula?
I'm ready.
Frankenstein, then let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we are back. So, Ed, why don't you summarize the situation about what's going on with immigrants who enroll in the military?
Well, it's obviously very fluid at the moment. We don't know what the final outcome is going to be, but there's been a lot in the news in the past couple of days that apparently the military has begun to discharge immigrants who joined the service. Under a program whereby if a foreign national enlists in the military and serves, that this gets them on a fast track towards naturalization and citizenship. And for whatever reason, the administration has decided that they want to reverse that trend, and they're actually discharging a lot of these people. And I assume that means they're probably then going to go on and deport them back to their previous country, because they won't be green card holders. I wouldn't imagine. I don't know.
So, but here are a couple things to take to just be a little cautious of this, because I saw this headline too. It was from the Associated Press. The actual article, just to point people at it, was from July 6th. U.S. Army quietly discharging immigrant recruits, but. And reading the headline and the initial article by the AP, it looks really bad. It looks like they're taking people from this program and they're just kicking them out willy-nilly just because they don't want to have these kind of people in the military anymore. But what the article calls out is something like 40 people out of, you know, a number that is in the six digits, I believe, in terms of the number of people in this program.
The number that the New York Times mentioned today is that between 2001 and 2017, there have been 125,450 immigrant soldiers, servicemen.
And so they're specifically talking about, this article covered like along the order of 40 or 50 people who have been affected by this. And they were not yet fully enrolled. It was like they were kicked out before they hit basic training. What the excuse they are giving is that they're not passing the background check. So apparently when you sign on the dotted line to enter, and you probably know better than I do, Ed, but when you sign on the dotted line to enter the military before you actually are fully enrolled, they do a little bit of a background check, make sure you're not a criminal, blah, blah, blah. And under certain circumstances, they'll say, no, you can't go any farther. They also have, even once you start, there's something like a 3 to 6 month sort of trial period where they can kick you out. If various things are going wrong, where they basically just say, hey, it's not working out. See you later. And basically these people are getting caught up in that time period, and it's related to the background check. Now, I've seen a couple different things about this in terms of, you know, the people who are being rejected in this way are being told it's due to the background check, but aren't being told any additional information. But I start listening to that. I'm like, well, do people usually get told in detail why they don't pass a background check? Or do they just say, sorry, you didn't pass? So I'm not sure how unusual that is. So this story is ringing at least a few alarm bells, because it tells you the situation now, but it doesn't tell you, well, what's normal? What, you know, okay. So 40 people in the last few months were denied. How many were denied a year ago? How many were denied 2 years ago? Is this up from where it used to be? Or is there a trend here where we're denying more people at this level than we were during the Obama administration? Or are we just choosing to highlight this now because everything else is going on with immigration and we want to, and so it's being highlighted now and somebody's pushing this as an agenda. And I just don't have that information right now. Yep. Now, the other thing I've heard, though, I was listening to a report on, I don't know, I think it was MSNBC, on these reasons for denials, because there was at least one set of documentation that leaked of, that had the additional details on why they didn't pass their background check. And they didn't pass their background check because they had foreign connections. Well, they're an immigrant. Yeah. Their parents are from another country. Their friends are from another country. Well, of course they do. But that's true of everybody in that category. So what's the reason here? But so I've seen a bunch of people I trust jump on this story and be like, this is a really bad thing. It's just another sign of the administration acting to get rid of immigrants because they don't like immigrants. But there's some missing pieces of information here that I would really like to see to understand this situation, because, you know, like I said, I want to see the trend line. I want to see what was the normal situation in terms of how this worked prior to Donald Trump and compare it to now. And is there a real difference, or are we just highlighting this now because people want to highlight it right now? And I frankly just don't know that answer. And also the other part of that that makes me ask is just the numbers. Like, we're talking 40 or 50 out of 100,000. That's a pretty small number. If you were really trying to dismantle that program, and by the way, the 100,000 is how many got in through this program over a number of years. There are about 10,000 currently serving. But even still, like 50 or 100 out of 10,000, we're talking, like, if let's say it's 100, that's like 1%. If you were really trying to roll back this program, you know, just denying like 1% of the people ain't doing it.
Yeah. No, I think it's very early in whatever is going on there to know. It just, it's, I suspect with most administrations, it wouldn't even come up. This administration has a record of not liking immigrants, and it sort of starts setting red flags. So there may be absolutely nothing wrong going on here. It just, you know, it's just kind of one of the ongoing string of things.
You sort of lose... The thing is, I guess, that Donald Trump loses the benefit of the doubt in this administration. So if you see something weird, like you automatically, at least for those of us on the left or side of the political spectrum, you automatically assume the worst. But that's not necessarily helpful. We still need to have that critical view of things, where you do want to look at the facts. You want to make sure you're not just feeding into the narrative that you're predisposed to see. Like, and I just don't know. There may well be something going on here that's nefarious, that is anti-immigrant, that is whatever. But just reading the story that came out here by itself isn't enough yet. And so I'd be very interested to see what comes out over the next few days or weeks. But on a number of cases, we've had sort of these mini Trump scandals erupt in the past where they have had to sort of backtrack because it turns out people were making assumptions that just weren't true. And because something looked like there was something bad going on, and you didn't look deeper because, well, of course, it's Donald Trump. He's doing this bad thing. And so you start writing it up and you start talking about it, and it goes viral, and everybody's talking about how this, and then you find out, well, no, actually, you know, Donald Trump is doing a lot of bad things, but that particular thing, that wasn't really happening, you know? And so we just have to be careful. And I think that's my go-to on this story, is that, and maybe by the time you guys are listening to this show, even though it'll only be less than 24 hours after we're recording this, well, I don't know how long it'll be till you listen to it, but I'll release it less than 24 hours from now. Maybe there'll already be a lot of clarity around this that isn't there when we're recording it, but you just gotta be careful, you know, like we, you know, Yvonne and I, and you too, Ed, I think, have criticized a lot of the Trumpies for being extremely credulous and believing whatever Donald Trump tells them and blah, 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 blah. We got to be careful too, you know, because it's very easy to fall into this trap of, well, it's Donald Trump, so it must be bad, or the worst, it must be the worst case scenario. No, it's not always the worst case scenario. Sometimes there's a more rational explanation, and maybe
at least 5% of the time he's all right.
Well, not even, but you know, it's like, there was the case early on in this, this scandal with the immigrant kids. There was this, the person who posted the picture of kids in cages that turned out to have been taken during the Obama administration. Yeah. And then immediately was like, oh, well, and let's get rid of that then, and never mind, blah, blah, blah. Because they just saw the picture and assumed it was recent and blah, 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 and they posted it. And it didn't feed into the narrative they wanted, which was Donald Trump has started all this stuff and it's evil and blah, 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 which, you know, Donald Trump has certainly increased things and made things worse, but there were bad things going on during Obama too. And so it all comes together, but you can't just the first time you see something pop up, just immediately go just by the headline. Cause I think this AP story in specific is typical of this, where it's like, if you read the headline only and the first couple paragraphs, it's easy to jump to a certain conclusion. But if you read the whole thing and read it carefully, you're like, well, what they've actually said is actually really limited and doesn't necessarily draw that conclusion. There's not enough there yet. So.
Well, time will tell. We'll know. But I think it's worth keeping an eye on.
It definitely is. And so let's talk more broadly, though, that this is one of the programs that has been in place, frankly, you know, since the Revolutionary War. We've always had immigrants in the armed service, and it's been a path to full American citizenship under the basic, you know, idea that, hey, if you've been serving this country in the military, what better way to sort of prove your loyalty and that you would be a good citizen? So let you in.
You know,
and I think one of the reasons that this story does have resonance is because whatever the specifics come up of this, Donald Trump's administration has so clearly shown an animus towards immigrants of all sorts, but especially the brown ones, that it's instantly believable that they would be trying to get rid of immigrants out of the armed forces or anywhere else, because they just don't want them here. They'd rather them be elsewhere. And that's why it sort of, you know, immediately pops with everybody that, oh my God, look what they're doing now.
Yep.
Okay. I guess we've reached the end of that. I've already like repeated myself three times, so I won't do it again. It's time to move on. One last topic, the trade war, the ongoing trade war. We'll be back. You forgot all about the trade war, you know, we'll be back right after this.
Hey, we know when you listen to this show, you have thoughts about what we say. You probably want to vent about what we got wrong or what we left out, right? Or maybe you want to suggest some future topics we just haven't gotten to yet. Well then, tell us all about it. Right now, there are four ways to get feedback to us. First, you can go to the Curmudgeon's Corner Facebook page and leave comments on the post where we announce all the new episodes. Second, you could go to curmudgeonscorner.com, that's with a hyphen, and leave a comment there instead. Third, both Yvonne and I are on Twitter. You can talk to me at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E, or Yvonne at I-M-B-O, I-M-B-O-U. Finally, if you don't want to make your comments in a public forum like that, just email me directly at abulsme@abulsme.com. Again, that's A-B-U-L-S-M-E. But, you know, if you don't want us to mention your feedback on the show, be sure to say so, because otherwise we're probably going to respond to your comments on a future show. Because, you know, that's what makes the discussion. Thanks, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, here we are. So the latest, and this is another topic that Yvonne and I talked a little bit about last week, but the latest round of sanctions against China, well, not sanctions, tariffs against China, went into place within the last 24 hours as we're recording this, and China immediately retaliated with tariffs against us, and we're on.
Yep.
And there's talk about further rounds happening. And there were quotes that came out this week from various people in the administration basically talking about how they didn't believe there was any risk in putting these tariffs in place because nobody would retaliate. Because America was so powerful from a trade perspective and no one would retaliate. Not the Chinese, not the Europeans, not the Canadians. And so they would just, you know, we'd put this into place and they'd capitulate on whatever we wanted and we'd be done.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, what we are seeing is we are, of course, seeing retaliation from everybody we're putting tariffs against. And this is another place where, like what we were saying with the Supreme Court, things take a while. Like, you don't have an instantaneous overnight response to things. It takes a while to percolate through the economy and for things to have effects. And so, you know, where's the connection and how do we make it? It's been less than 24 hours since these last set of things went into place. And, you know, the economy hasn't collapsed yet. And maybe 3 weeks from now, we don't know. So,
It hasn't collapsed, but it's moves much faster than Supreme Court. Apparently, soybean futures are down 15% already, just since this began. We know that the price of automobiles and various other things of that is going up and will continue going up. We know that Harley-Davidson probably is going to move manufacture of their small cycles that they have been exporting to Europe. They're going to move that somewhere else because they can't pay the tariff on the stuff that's going to go on. So we're losing some manufacturing. There's that one screw factory they've talked about that was making things. There's a small factory, I think it is in Italy, that makes some specific sort of a knife that is used in Iran to make leather goods.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting ready to move and build a big factory in Iran. But with the scuttling of the Iranian negotiations, they've cut back and they said, well, we can't do that because we may not be allowed to trade. We're not going to invest, you know, $50 million building a factory and then have to close it. So there are things that already occurring in this war that are hurting people.
Yeah, I mean, clearly. I mean, when I say things take a while, they take a while to percolate through the whole economy enough so that most people feel it, et cetera. And, you know, there's a question of, well, how big will the effect be anyway? Like, if it costs me an extra, you know, $10 a month, I might not notice that. If it costs me an extra $100 a month, that's much more likely to be noticed by a lot more people. And, you know, when we talk to Yvonne about this, he always says it's sort of, he expects it to take a few months to sort of work its way through so that we see the effects. But you're right. If you're in one of the areas directly targeted, you're going to feel it a lot sooner.
Well, the other thing is what will begin occurring in a few months is if, let's say the overall impact is an increased cost of living of 3 or 4%. You say, well, that's not a whole lot. However, that begins affecting what we buy. And so we don't buy some things. And the cascade affecting of all that sort of stuff goes out for years. And it doesn't even begin to peak for 4 or 5 years. But when it peaks in what's known as a recession.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if so, the $30 billion cost to the economy right now is nothing. I mean, the worldwide economy is $7 trillion. I think I saw the other day. So a $300 or $400 billion cost is nothing. It's not even a tenth of a percent. However, it begins to cascade, and it's not the $300 billion this year. to $600 billion next year, and then $1.5 trillion a year after that as it cascades. And, you know, the small factory that closes that leads to the bigger factory having to cut down, that leads to a whole industry saying, well, shit, we're going to stop making this particular product altogether. And it's, you know, as you said, our president deals in zero-sum games, that you either profit or you lose in international trade. That's not the way it works. In real international trade, both sides win.
That's the whole point of trade.
Yeah, I mean, we get something for our money that we have generated and made. They get to sell something that they don't really need.
Well, and the other part of that is that I've seen a number of analysts point out that, you know, when Trump starts spewing out numbers and such, first of all, he's making stuff up a lot. So it's hard to even match what he's saying to reality. But the
I don't even listen to his numbers. They just are meaningless.
But
numbers.
The closest thing you can come to getting his numbers to match reality is if you ignore the services part of the economy and only look at manufacturing. Yeah. And of course, at this point, this economy is driven more by services than manufacturing. That transition happened decades ago. But Donald Trump is stuck in a 1950s or 1960s mindset, or at the latest, the 80s, but probably the 50s or 60s, and thinking of the economy as manufacturing. And if you look at manufacturing only, some of the things he says about trade deficits and such, I'm not saying they make sense from a policy perspective, but at least you can sort of understand where the number comes from if you look at only that. But the problem is he's not looking at the whole picture. And he's only looking at, in many cases, he's only looking at certain industries, and these sometimes are industries that are specifically targeted for the states he did well in the election with. So, for instance, you know, he'll go after, you know, some of the Rust Belt manufacturing, steel, et cetera, and say, we have to improve this industry because, you know, they're from my states, you know, while not taking into account the fact that, you know, okay, well, if you do this to steel, it's going to impact the car industry, and it's going to do this, and how everything's interconnected, and how, you know, hey, an American car isn't 100% made in America and hasn't been for decades either, because the parts come from all over the world, and vice versa. The German cars are made in South Carolina, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he just doesn't go to that step because that's not how he envisions the world. Because, again, how he's envisioning the world is decades out of date. And his policies probably wouldn't have been good if you implemented them decades ago either. But they're even worse now because they just don't recognize the reality of what the economy looks like today.
Yeah.
And
I think he's got people advising him that are, you know, we keep hearing this term robbing, that using the United States as a piggy bank, that they're robbing. And you hear that from all sorts of, so someone in that administration comes up with that sort of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And then he picks up on it. And the next thing you know, it's all over everywhere because, well, Donnie said it must be true. Well, yeah, there's a reason they like our piggy bank, and it's because it's a really good piggy bank.
So I don't know what else to say about the economy. We had new job numbers out today, which show for now continued job growth. Now, of course, Donald Trump's taking credit for it. But if you look at the curve going back years, you'll see there's no inflection point at all when he took office or anywhere near it. We're basically just continuing the same trend we've been on, you know, for something like 7 or 8 years now.
And from 2009 until 2017, that curve was way too slow and it was not enough. And suddenly in 2017, it became the greatest numbers ever, according to the Republican Party. Same amount of increase in the, you know, jobs, but it's now wonderful. And it was then it was bad.
Yes, yeah. Of course. but, you know, so in terms of the day-to-day stuff, we're not seeing that sort of macro impact on the economy as a whole from anything Trump's done so far. And then again, this goes back to the lag factor that I talked about before in terms of, you know, how long does it take after you enact a bad policy before you see the results in a big enough scale to show up in the overall economic numbers? And the answer is it takes a while. You know, things
in the case of economy, it probably takes years.
Yeah, potentially.
But it it does. I mean, if you think that the recession of 2006-07 range was a result of the Bush economic package of tax cuts and the elimination of bank regulation, that sort of stuff, then it took about 4 or 5 years.
Right.
But then when it hit like a, you know, a damn freight train running over a tractor.
Yeah. So, I mean, Yvonne last week predicted that we're going to see a recession out of these policies before we get to the election in 2020. Maybe. That would say that we need a couple years for this really to fully bake in. If it takes 3 or 4 years, we won't see it till halfway through the next administration, whether that be a second Donald Trump term or the first term of a Democratic president, or I guess another Republican who successfully challenges Donald Trump. But I don't see that happening right now. And then people always blame what's going on then. So like as an example, let's say we did have a Democratic president start in 2021, and then the results of all this stuff hit hard in 2022. Well, that new Democratic president is going to be blamed no matter what, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be his fault.
That's just the way it works. It happened on their watch, right? So we'll see.
The last one occurred during Bush's watch, and Obama was still blamed.
True. By some people, for sure. But in any case, here with this, I think one of the questions, though, is like, is Donald Trump steering into the crash? You know, because if at every point in the cycle, he makes the decision that's going to make it worse, we could get, frankly, we've been in a growth cycle. It was, like you said, perhaps slower than some people would like, but we've been in a growth cycle since 2009 now. We're probably due for a recession anyway. At some point, before too long, you know, it's just part of the natural cycles of economies, right? But you would expect, if it sort of happened naturally, to be hopefully a rather shallow one and blah, blah, blah. And the Fed and everybody else takes whatever actions they need to minimize it. But if Donald Trump is doing things which economists are saying, you're doing exactly the wrong thing. You know, you're doing something which will hurt the economy specifically. It's not going to help the economy. It's not going to make things better. You're going to make things worse. And if you're consistently making those kinds of decisions over and over again, it'll be interesting to see whether that accelerates the process of getting us into a bad place or not. Or the flip side, are all the economists wrong? And this will magically work out the way Donald Trump and his folks say it will. And at some point, all of the other countries will scream uncle, eliminate all their trade barriers, and the U.S. gets to declare victory and say, we're great now. Or the medium thing, which I've mentioned in a couple of shows before, which is Donald Trump doesn't need a real victory. He just needs to have something that looks like a victory. So if some of these countries that we're throwing tariffs on would respond by saying, ooh, you got me here, we'll change this little thing over here that doesn't really matter, but would be a visible thing that they could say they were giving in to Donald Trump on, then Donald Trump could conceivably declare victory and go home and turn everything off. And that's the kind of thing I could see him doing. But, you know, a lot of the countries we're putting the screws on are just not going to have that. They're not going to say, they're not going to give that, they're not going to give him that win.
I don't think so, because I'm not sure they need to. Many of you know, in the Pacific, where the TPP is going on, those nations have gotten together and said, we don't need them. We can trade with each other. In the case of Mexico, they're buying their grain from other places. Our exports of grain to Mexico are dropping, and the Mexican farmers are happy because apparently we've been selling grain in Mexico at a cost under what they can produce it for. So we've been killing the Mexican farmers off. So I'm not sure they're going to need us when this gets back, which gets up to the issue. You know, there's going to be a recession somewhere along the line. There always is. These things go cyclically, whatever you do. But traditionally, when a recession occurs, there's several things the government can do that help to shorten it and make it less painful. The government can cut taxes, which puts more money into the economy. It can increase governmental spending, which puts more money into the economy. And it can start building infrastructure, which is basically spending more money. Well, the trouble is right now, the taxes have been cut. It's probably about as low as you dare cut them. And that makes it pretty hard because we cut them as the economy is going up in a good time. It's pretty damn hard to justify continuing to increase government spending when this year we're going to be $850 billion deficit spending. And what weapons does the government have left to treat the recession when it occurs?
Yep. Very, very important point. And the Fed has certain levers they can push. The government has certain levers they can push. But if you've already exhausted all of them before you have the crisis, then it becomes a lot harder.
Yep. And interest rates are still very, very low. So they can't really cut that very much.
A few countries have proven over the last few years that you actually can go negative on interest rates and people will still do it in the right conditions. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I think you gave it a good summary. We can't say anything other than let's see what happens. All of the experts are saying that what Donald Trump is doing is stupid and is going to cause problems, but it may take 6 months or a year or more to really see that the full impact. Like you said, some things we can see the impact already, but it takes a while to percolate through everywhere. So we're just going to be watching for a long time.
Yeah. Do you realize you just quoted him?
Did I?
We'll see what happens. That's one of his favorites. Every time he says that, my wife looks at me and says, "See, he said it again." Sorry about that.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay. I think we've done a show, Ed. I think we're done.
Sounds good. I'm going to go to bed.
So thanks, everybody, for listening to yet another Curmudgeon's Corner. You guys all know how this goes. For any new people, I'll tell you this. For the people who've been listening for a while, I know this last couple minutes of the show is repetitive because I say the same damn thing every time. But, it's important for new folks, especially. If you haven't already, go to facebook.com/curmudgeonscorner. Like us there. Share the new episodes with your friends. Tell them that you should listen to the show, assuming you like the show and want to recommend it to your friends. You can find us on Twitter as well. I'm at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E. My normal co-host, Yvonne, is at I-M-B-O-U. Ed is not on Twitter. Poor Ed.
No, I don't like Twitter.
Yeah. But if you have a message for Ed or want to comment on what Ed's saying, feedback@curmudgeons-corner.com will get to me and I will pass it on to Ed. And I'll mention also feedback wise, I had feedback this last week from my mother about last week's rant by Yvonne about baby boomers. I'm saving it till when Yvonne is here. Although Ed, you could potentially react to that too. He sort of ranted on people in your age group and how awful you are. So,
I admit it. I'm absolutely a slacker these days. All I do is live on my Social Security, my pension, and I'm running triathlons.
There you go. So anyway, and finally, if you want to help out the show with our monthly expenses or just to tip us and because you appreciate us, patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner. You can go there and drop us a couple bucks a month or whatever. And for $2 a month or more, you can get on our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, where all week long, Yvonne and I and Ed usually, and a whole bunch of other people are often on there chatting about the news of the week, in between these shows, and tossing around potential topics and chatting about whatever's going on that day. And sometimes other miscellaneous talk, about what's going on in our lives and stuff like that. You could join in and be a part of that as well. And there we go. That's the end. Thank you, everybody. And thank you, Ed, for coming in and doing this show at really last minute's notice. Ed had less than 2 hours notice between when I sent out an appeal for please, I need a co-host, and when we started this show. So I really appreciate that, Ed.
Always enjoy it.
And Yvonne, wherever you are, I hope you feel better. Get better. Take care of yourself. And we'll see you all next week. Goodbye.
Good night.